You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Cyber Week deals at BJ's Wholesale Club are so great, we called in the North Pole's top IT expert to tell you about them.
Al the IT elf here. This time of year, I'm asking everyone two things. Have you tried rebooting? And have you seen BJ's Cyber Week savings? Through December 7th, get a $20 digital coupon when you spend $200. Plus, through December 4th, get up to 40% off TVs, tech, and appliances. And like remembering your password, remember that these deals are only on BJ's.com or the BJ's app.
Visit BJ's.com/cyberweek for holiday savings.
Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today. Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
You're not anxious? Not nervous at all for this episode?
No, not at all. Who, me? No. Anxious? Never.
Yeah.
No. Do we have anything we have to talk about before we get started? Or?
Not really. Not pertaining to our show.
Okay. Cool. All right.
You're still breathing. Keeping breathing.
Yeah. We're trying. We're doing that. I'm just a little bit nervous to talk about this story. It is a really big and hard thing to talk about and to hear, and it's really upsetting. I'm not laughing,
uncomfortably.
I'm uncomfortably laughing. This story does I will be talking about child abuse. So if that's not something you feel you can listen to today, I totally understand. Just come back next week. We're going to be telling a much lighter story next week. So,
Yeah, but if you do want to listen...
But if you do want to hear this...
Here we are.
Yeah, if you do want to hear this insane story, here we are. We're going to talk about it. So we're going to be talking about the Turpin family. And this story kind of broke pretty recently, to be honest. I'm pretty sure it's 2018 when this whole thing came to light, which... is obviously it's still kind of fresh, which is also kind of scary, but also I just felt like we should talk about it just because I feel like everyone who came in contact with these children failed them. Everyone failed them. And it's one of those things where it's like the bystander effect where
Oh my God, I am not going to do well with this story.
Yeah. It's like, you can't even wrap your head around what these children went through. It's insane. So yeah, I just think that it's important to talk about because it really is you see something, you say something. And I just kind of want to really drive that home because there were so many opportunities for people to say something and nobody did. Mm-hmm. So, it's a lot. So we're going to get into it. We're going to be talking about David and Louise Turpin. They are the parents of these children. They had 13 children we're going to talk about. And I'm going to start by telling you a little bit of background on David and Louise Turpin. And, if we ever feel any sort of sympathy or whatever for Louise Turpin, we can feel bad for her in the beginning because she's a child. And then once she is no longer a child, we can all agree that she is absolutely one of the worst people to ever walk planet Earth. Both of these people are pure, pure evil. And I just want to keep everyone in the same under the same blanket. We all know that these are evil people.
All right, okay.
Because the beginning is a little bit, she doesn't have a great childhood. But anyway, So David Allen Turpin was born on October 17th, 1961, and his family was deeply devout, and every Sunday they attended the Princeton Church of God in West Virginia. One summer, the Turpin family became friends with the Robinette family, who also attended the same church, and they had three daughters, Elizabeth, Teresa, and Louise. So Louise Anna Turpin was, well, not at the time, she wasn't Turpin, she was Robinette, but Louise Robinette was born May 24th, 1968. David and Louise met through their church when David was 17, almost 18 years old, and Louise was around 10 or 11. And according to David, he had a crush on Louise from when she was 10 years old. So
that's a little weird.
Yeah, so we're starting this shit out creepy, you know? We're gonna start it out creepy and we're gonna keep it creepy. They both grew up in, you know, this deeply devout Pentecostal church, and they lived fairly close to each other and would see each other all the time. So Louise's father was a pastor and her mother was just a deeply sick person. Louise and her siblings would endure regular sexual abuse from their grandfather because their mother would bring the girls to her father's house, and in exchange for money, she would leave her children with her father, who was a pedophile.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No, I'm not. So she was knowingly bringing her children to the home of a predator and pretty much selling her children to her own father.
She was prostituting her own children to her father.
Yes, and that's why I kind of gave the disclaimer, like, this is the part where we can feel bad for child Louise, because that's fucked. But, you know, after this, it's like...
Wow.
It's everything.
It is so sad, though, because it's just a cycle.
Yeah, no, it's terrible. This is absolutely terrible, and I can't even imagine that being, like, something worse. Yeah, like, that's insane.
We're, like, not even 5 minutes in.
Right. So, in school, Louise was a loner and was bullied a lot and just had a very hard upbringing, you know, obviously. And David, on the other hand, had a different experience. Some people did think he was a little weird, but he was very, very smart. He was the head of the chess team and on the honor roll. He was the treasurer of the Bible club. He sang in the a cappella group, and he would dress kind of formally every single day. He was extremely involved, and everyone knew him, and he was, you know, known as a nerd, but he was almost popular. So he had a very different experience than Louise. Yeah,
Jesus, night and day.
Right. So you can only imagine the influence that he would have had on this, you know, 10 or 11-year-old as a 17-year-old popular kid who was flirting with her. So
he's flirting with her at 10 and 11.
Yes, yeah. He had a crush on her, and he wanted to be with her.
That is disgusting.
Yeah. So only about a year or two later, David and Louise officially started dating, but kind of in secret. And when Louise's mother found out, she didn't care, because, I mean, why would Louise's mother care about anything? Because
she's already, yeah.
Right. Because she said that David was a, quote, good boy, although she never told Louise's father because he wouldn't have agreed with the age difference.
As anyone should.
Right.
Where is the father, like, is he complicit in this, like, prostituting of his own children?
I don't know. I don't think he knew. I don't know.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
He didn't know.
I don't know. It's possible he didn't know. I don't know.
Yeah. I want to know where he's at.
He's a pastor. He's like a very, you know, devout pastor, strict father figure kind of guy. So I feel like he probably didn't know. And Louise would tell her mother that she was going to marry David one day and have 12 of his children.
Holy shit, that's a lot of children.
Yeah. So from pretty much like 12 or 13 years old, she's like, yep, I'm going to marry David and I'm going to have 12 of his children. David Turpin graduated from Virginia Tech in 1984. And by 1985, David and Louise planned to elope when he was 24 and she was only 17 years old. But also, Louise looked a lot younger than she actually was. So it was, you know, even creepier. Although Louise's sister, Elizabeth, thinks that part of the reason Louise agreed to elope with David was to get away from her grandfather, because this...
Oh, who can blame her?
I mean, I don't. I don't blame her for that. And right before they eloped, David posed as her father. That way, he could pick her up from school, and the two of them could run away together.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're posing as... Okay.
Right, that's where we're at. So David got a job with General Dynamics in Fort Worth, Texas. So after David picked her up from school that day, they made their way to Texas. And when Louise's parents found out, her father was absolutely furious. Her mother also contacted the police. And days later in Fort Worth, the couple was picked up by an officer. Louise's mother wanted to press charges for kidnapping, but David and Louise begged her parents to refrain from pressing charges, and Louise's parents agreed and actually signed over written consent for David to be married to their daughter because, you know, she was still a minor and they had to, like, sign her over, essentially. I think her father did that because he was worried that if he didn't sign her over, that she'd have premarital sex, God forbid. So that was his reasoning, and which is not right, but also, I don't know.
It's like that was what you were most concerned about?
Yes, exactly. That's my point. Like, he was most concerned about her potentially having premarital sex. Oh my God. So, whatever.
Like, dude, there's bigger issues here.
Yeah, exactly. And after that, the couple agreed to drive back to Princeton, where they had a small marriage ceremony only attended by a small group of family members, and then they moved back to Fort Worth. Louise kept in touch with her sister Elizabeth, but cut off contact with the rest of her family, which I don't blame her for, because this
didn't she have another sister too?
She did, yeah. And she'll kind of go back and forth on this, like, I am in touch with my family, I'm not in touch with my family. Like, she'll flip-flop. So, but for now, she's only in contact with Elizabeth. And so David was working as a mechanical engineer, and he was making really good money. So Louise was having the time of her life. The couple would go out for dinner all the time. They went on trips. They went to a bunch of live entertainment. Louise was living the life of her dreams. And in 1987, the couple moved to Brea, California, because David was being transferred. Even though things between Jennifer and her family were still strained at this point, she made an effort to show how great her life had become. And that's just kind of the theme of this whole story. Louise really depicted her life in one way to have it seem as if she was living this fairy tale life, but that wasn't what was going on behind closed doors. But, you know, she's very much like, I'm going to post a picture of my great life and I'm going to tell you that I'm spending so much money and we bought a million cars and blah, 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 because she just wanted to, like, you know, keep up this facade. And so she would write letters to her family back in Princeton and basically brag about how great everything was for her and her husband. And on July 28th, 1988, they had their first child, Jennifer Dawn. They would go on to have 13 kids after this, like I mentioned in the beginning, and all of them had J names, which is...
How do you keep track?
Yeah.
My mom, like, mixes up my brother and my name because we both start with A.
Right.
So I can't even imagine.
Yeah, that times, you know,
just
13.
Think, just start assigning them numbers.
Pretty much. And when David and Louise had Jennifer, they flew out Louise's family and they paid for everything. They took them to all the local tourist locations. They took them to dinner. They put on a really big show and they paid for their, like, plane tickets and everything. So they were doing the most. And in 1990, David was transferred again and the family returned to Fort Worth. They moved into this really good neighborhood, into a big old house, and continued to have Louise's family visit constantly and continued to pay their way for everything. So her family really believed that Louise had made it and she had this perfect life. One of her sisters would say she didn't marry for looks, but she married for money. Because, spoiler alert, David's ugly as fuck. He's got this weird ass haircut. He's ugly as shit. So,
well,
yeah. And even after all these trips, her sisters said they never really got to know David. He was just very reserved and quiet, and he just kind of sat back and observed. He didn't really talk to her family.
Ooh, that's giving me chills.
Yeah.
That's a red flag.
Yeah. And by 1993, they had already had two more children. And although David was making a six-figure salary, they weren't in a good place because they were definitely spending beyond their means. They maxed out all their credit cards and went really deeply into debt, which was only made worse when Louise acquired a gambling addiction.
Acquired.
I mean, yeah. I don't know. What would you say?
I don't know. I've never heard it said
like
that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But damn, was she like, what's her thing? She's going to like the slots?
I don't know if it was, I don't know, she's just going to casinos and gambling away all her money.
Yeah, not great.
Well, not even all her money, all her husband's money, but, you know, whatever. So there was that, and on top of that, they were still spending, like, an astronomical amount on things they didn't need. Like, Louise would brag to her family that David would buy a brand new Mustang every single year, which you don't need. I can say confidently, you don't need a brand new Mustang every single year, but that's what they were doing. And by this time, their oldest daughter, Jennifer, started going to school and was in the first grade, but was getting bullied really, really badly. Kids would make fun of her because she smelled really bad. And she was just this little first grader, and every time she would walk by, a classmate would, like, pinch their nose and be like, "Ew, Jennifer, you stink," and blah, blah, blah. Like, they would really, you know, they weren't quiet about it. They were mean little kids.
Kids are dicks.
Yeah. And she was 2 years older than all her classmates. She had a foul odor. She had this long, always greasy hair that was never brushed. She was missing her two front teeth, and she would wear the same pair of jean overalls and white floral top every single day, and was also visibly very frail.
Wow. Yeah, she's just so different. Just a target for sure.
Well, yeah, not only is she, like, very different from all of her classmates in that, but she also has multiple signs that something is wrong.
Yeah.
Like, what I want to know is, how did not one teacher or adult at that school say anything? Because I know that it was, like, you know, 1980, whatever, and times were different. But as an adult, how do you see this child coming to school every single day in the same clothing? They're dirty, they're smelly, and, you know, whatever. And all the kids are bullying them, and they look like they're starving, and you don't say anything.
Yeah.
This could have been stopped here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This could have been over right here.
Yeah, because, like, if in first grade, is that what she's in?
Yeah.
Like, you don't know how to do your own hygiene when you're in first grade. This is
right.
A complete reflection
of the
parents' treatment of their own child.
Exactly.
Like, if you can't even bathe your child, what else can you not do?
She's wearing the same clothes every day.
Yeah.
And, like, I know that, you know, when it comes to that, like, it could have been a money problem, whatever, like, you know, maybe she couldn't afford different clothes and whatever,
okay.
But that's not true.
But
because
yeah.
Her parents were going out and spending lavishly on themselves. She was gambling away all her money. They're buying a Mustang every single year. They're going to dinner every night. Like, they had money. They had
yeah.
a nice house in a nice neighborhood.
Yep.
And this little girl is coming to school, smelling dirty, wearing the same clothes, missing teeth, and looks like she's starving. So I'm already very angry because this could have been ended right here.
Yeah. The other thing that really pisses me off is, like, the just non-intervention of any of the teachers or adults at school when a child is being bullied.
Yeah.
And, like, they see it.
Yeah.
And, like, especially, it's like they were being very obvious about it.
Yeah, they were.
Nothing is done.
And she would be sent to the principal. Like, Jennifer would be sent to the principal for, you know, whatever reason, because she smelled or whatever, and they would just send her back to class. And the saddest part of all of this is that little Jennifer, first grade, probably 6 or 7 or 8 year old Jennifer, I don't know how old you are, was known to be kind and energetic. She was a kind little girl.
Ugh.
Who was just dealt the shittiest hand. Like, what? It just makes me so sad.
Yeah.
But she was still definitely an outcast, and most of her classmates just kind of avoided her, which is very sad. So by 1995, Louise had her fourth child, and by this time, David and Louise and her four children traveled to visit Louise's family. They dressed their children all in identical outfits, and this is when Louise's family started to notice weird things about the family. Her sister Teresa recalled that her sister and David were overly strict with their children. For starters, the kids would all walk in a straight line. Teresa said that it was more like a school than it was a family, or, you know, like a military training kind of thing. Like, they were like really strict. And her kids also had to ask to use the bathroom or get something to eat or drink. Like, they had to ask for every single thing. They couldn't do anything on their own. Her family thought this was a little weird, but nothing super alarming at this point. They're just like, okay, they're overly strict. That's the end of the story.
Yeah, but, like, overly strict is kind of an understatement if you have to ask for food.
Yeah.
Or ask to go to the bathroom. I don't know.
Yep. And so during that trip, Louise's sister Elizabeth asked if she would be able to spend the summer with them because, you know, she didn't have a job tying her down, and she was like, can I stay with you guys? So pretty much immediately, Elizabeth started to see things that weren't great in her sister's seemingly perfect life. So the first thing she was exposed to was Louise's gambling addiction and their money problems. She also immediately noticed that Louise and David never showed any love or affection toward their children. No I love yous, no hugs, barely any touching, and she wouldn't even really hold her baby. So
what? How does you raise a baby, like a child? You have to touch them to feed them, change their diaper.
Yeah, I mean, it was like absolutely.
Did they have a nanny?
No. Did they? No.
I'm just asking, no. Like, you have to touch your child to feed it.
Yeah, no, for sure. But I mean, these children weren't taken care of. This is,
I get it.
So the kids also had to, you know, like we said, ask to do anything, like go to the bathroom, ask to eat, or even leave their bedroom. So they were in their bedrooms for like most of the day. They were like pretty much locked in their bedrooms. So that was when Elizabeth was there. Also, their dinner time was kind of this really big production. So Louise would set the table and then she'd call the children one by one to come to the table. And then once they were at the table, Jennifer would have to stand, look her mother in the eye and smile. And then once the smile was returned, Jennifer could sit down and then she would have to wait for permission to eat. Then once Jennifer was done eating, she'd have to stand up, smile at her mother again, and then once the smile was returned, she was allowed to leave and return to her room. So this was every single night, this big production. Very weird.
What? This is like a prison.
Yes. Yes, it is. So the children spent most of their time confined to their rooms. They only spent time out of their rooms when their parents allowed it, and they were only able to interact with Elizabeth when Louise was present. So they couldn't talk to their aunt. It was really like spoke when you're spoken to, and you can't talk to Elizabeth without me here. Elizabeth and the children rarely spoke because Louise didn't really want them interacting. Her explanation for all of this was that she was trying to protect the children and she didn't want Elizabeth's beliefs to influence the children in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Also, she probably just didn't want the children saying anything that
Elizabeth would write. But like, what are Elizabeth's beliefs that you don't have? They were both very religious, no?
Yeah, but I think at this point, Louise is kind of branching out from her religious upbringing.
Oh, okay.
But that, you know, it's some bullshit.
It's bullshit. Yeah, I know, but...
So Elizabeth quickly became uncomfortable in the home, but never confronted Louise or David about anything. And she soon noticed that it took very little to enrage David. If Louise did anything he didn't want her to do, he'd get really, really mad and would physically abuse Louise in front of their children. He also didn't want Louise and Elizabeth doing anything without him. So Louise didn't want the children talking to Elizabeth without her present, and David didn't want Louise and Elizabeth to do anything without him present. So it was like this chain of command, you know?
Wow.
Very weird.
Doesn't he have to go to work, though?
Yes.
And she just can't talk to Elizabeth then?
Pretty much. I mean, I don't know, but it kind of seems that way. So Rick Ross, who is an expert on cults, considered David Turpin to be a cult leader, and his home was cultic in nature, and the children could only refer to their parents as father and mother. They had a ton of rules to follow, and they established that there was no need for them to leave the home even after the age of 18. So even when they became legal age, they remained in the home living like children. So they were just, they had these children like locked in this house essentially, and they didn't know anything else. Not long after moving in with them, Elizabeth got a job, and from there, things got only worse. And David and Louise told Elizabeth that she could never bring any friends over or even say where she lived, and she had a very strict set of rules, and if she broke any of them, they told her they'd just kick her out. They don't care. So things also became inappropriate. One day, while Elizabeth was taking a shower, Louise picked the lock on the door with a coat hanger, and then she and David went into the bathroom and watched Elizabeth take a shower. And she was extremely uncomfortable with this, but Louise and David would just laugh at her embarrassment and kind of just try to play off that it was like a joke. But this wasn't an isolated occurrence, and it would happen often. Elizabeth grew up in this extremely abusive situation, as Louise did as well, so she never did anything to really try to stop it, because at this point she was so used to tolerating this kind of treatment. And the abuse was definitely normalized for her. One day, Elizabeth got lunch with a friend from work after a shift, but when she called Louise to pick her up, she never answered. Elizabeth was told never to socialize, and for 3 days, Louise wouldn't pick up the phone, and Elizabeth slept on benches and went to work in the same clothes. When Louise finally answered the phone, she told Elizabeth to go back to Tennessee, where I guess she was living before, and she was only allowed to go back to their home to get her things before leaving for good. So Elizabeth is now gone. And by 1997, Louise had her 5th child, and Jennifer started the 2nd grade. Over that summer, her hygiene had only gotten worse, and a classmate recalled that she smelled like dirty clothes and urine.
And wait, so this all happened in like a year?
Yeah, that was a year. Yeah. And at this point, she was showing signs of abuse. You know, obviously, before she was showing signs of abuse, like, you know, she wasn't clean, whatever. But now she's kind of showing some signs of, like, potential sexual abuse. And so that is another thing that the teachers didn't pick up on and didn't say anything for. And she was sent to the office once before because of this, but nothing was done, and she was just sent back to class. So the weird part is, at home, Jennifer had a closet full of expensive dresses. Her closet was full of dresses that ranged anywhere from $200 to $400 each, and none of these dresses had ever even been touched. They still had the tags on them, and they were just collecting dust in the closet. So she had clothes, you know? She had these things, but they didn't give them to her. And she just, it was all a show. It was all a show. So in 1998, Louise had her 6th child, and by that time, Jennifer would have been in the 3rd grade, but she never went back to school. There was no real excuse given to the school, but she just never showed back up, and nobody did anything about it.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No.
You have to go to school till you're 16, right?
I don't know. Like, I mean, you have to go to school. It's the law, you know?
Are they, like, claiming she's being homeschooled? Or just, like, literally nothing?
They eventually did say that they were homeschooling the kids. But Jennifer was the only kid to ever go to school, and she had a 3rd grade, or a 2nd grade education level.
I mean, like, I don't know, how well can you do in school under these conditions? Are you fucking kidding me?
Well, it's not even about that. It's like the fact that, like, they pulled her out of school and then never taught their children ever
anything. I know, but I'm just saying, like, how much can you learn anyway?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, so instead of David teaching the children, they decided that Louise would, you know, teach them, quote unquote, even though she had dropped out of high school at, like, 16. So, really, best case scenario, if Louise did actually teach their children, she only had education up to the age of 16 anyway, you know? But yeah. She didn't teach her children. It was all for show, you know? It was all just excuses. And at this point, Louise's gambling addiction had led to the couple needing to file for bankruptcy and losing their home. When the home was sold, new sellers found that from the outside, the house looked great, but on the inside, it was absolutely filthy. There was filth everywhere. There was urine and feces caked into the carpets. There was large dark stains and scratches on the walls, and it took the owners 3 months to clean out the house, and they assumed that there were animals being kept in the house, and they didn't have any idea that it was from children.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Scratches on the wall?
Yes. Urine and feces everywhere. Everywhere. Ugh. Yeah. The family then moved to this really small town in Texas that had a population of like 700 people. So their closest neighbors were like miles away, and they lived in this bubble. And they really brainwashed these children into being terrified of the outside world. These children weren't even allowed to tell anyone their names. So they did have this one family as their neighbors. Ricky Lee and Shelley Vineyard lived across the street with their 2 young daughters. So, like, it was pretty much just these 2 houses, and then everything else was, like, really far away. At first, Ricky and Shelley's daughters were super excited that they had a bunch of kids their age as their new neighbors. But one afternoon, when a few of the kids were outside in the yard, Ashley and Barbara, who were their 2 girls, the daughters, went across the street and went over to play with them, but the Turpin children wouldn't even tell the girls their names. Anytime the girls would ask about their family or anything personal, the children would clam up and not say a word. So when Shelley, the girl's mother, came over to talk to the kids on one occasion, she was completely taken aback at the sight of one of the girls' hands. She said they were paper white, and when Shelley said, "Oh, I thought you were wearing gloves," to this, you know, Turpin child, the girl responded in a kind of, like, robotic tone, saying, "You wash to the wrist or else you're wasting water."
What the fuck? This is, like, out of a horror movie.
Yes. So, these children only washed their hands. Ever. Pretty much. Yep. So, the kids played together for a few weeks, but after Louise found out that Ashley and Barbara were asking these kids personal questions, they weren't allowed to see them again. And they remained in that house for the next 10 years. And the neighbors did think the Turpins were weird, and after time did see some really concerning things, but they said everyone just kind of minded their own business, and so they never said anything.
I hate that.
Yep. So now we're going to go into the next phase of the Turpin children's lockdown. The children slept during the day and were only allowed out of their rooms to use the bathroom. And they were nocturnal at this point. They would wake up at 11 p.m. and pretty much go back to sleep at like 3 or 4 a.m. And then they were asleep all day long, and then they would wake up at like 11 again.
Wow.
So the house would be quiet all day long, and then at night all the lights would be on in the house, but the curtains were drawn. And the kids would sometimes be allowed to go outside at night and play in the yard, but again, that didn't last very long either. And when it was time to eat, they were allowed into the kitchen one by one. They were allowed to brush their teeth, but had never been to a dentist. And in 2001, their youngest was bitten in the face by one of their dogs, but emergency services wasn't called for a whole 24 hours afterward. A day after this dog bite, an ambulance was called, and the little girl was given stitches, and even though this was reported to the sheriff's office, no officers were ever sent, and there was no follow-ups with the family.
You fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah, you were right. The incompetence, well, like, just the incompetence at every level.
Yeah.
Like, there was so many people that could have done something.
Yes.
Oh, it's going to get worse, too.
Yeah, it's going to get worse. Louise would often send photos of the children to her family, and in each picture, the children were all clean and wearing matching outfits. That was, like, her thing. The entire family would wear matching outfits everywhere. I mean, not everywhere, just in pictures, you know? And after seeing one of these pictures, Louise's sister, Teresa, said the children looked noticeably frail. But Louise's excuse to this was they were all just going to be tall and lanky, just like their father. So Teresa dropped it. Meanwhile, eating was never a problem for Louise and David. They would still go out to eat at the nicest restaurants, and they never brought their children. And Christmas of that year, David and Louise bought all the kids expensive bikes, but the kids were never allowed to ride them. They would all just set them out for the neighbors to see with the price tag still on and still on the handlebars, so people would know they had money, but the children never rode them. In May of 2004, David and Louise bought a double-wide trailer that they put on their property about 150 feet from the house, and the family then abandoned the house and all moved into this trailer because, again, their home wasn't even fit for animals to live there because it was filthy. By 2006, David and Louise had 12 children, and David had started a new form of punishment. He had constructed a cage that was 7 feet wide by 5 feet tall and was divided in half so two kids could be punished at once. The walls of this cage were lined with, you know, that like pegboard thing with holes in it that you see in like garages for hanging tools? So it was that. It was lined with that. And this was all over the walls of the cage, and only a small 5-inch gap at the bottom was left for food. And the kids would be kept in these cages for days at a time, and it was secured with a padlock. One of the children, who was 12 at the time, was able to escape by lifting up the bottom and crawling out, but David's response to this was to get a dog kennel that was also secured with a padlock. And the kennel was divided into 3x3 sections, and it was too small for any of the children to stand in. One of the boys, who was 16, said he was locked in this kennel for over a day after his mother caught him watching Star Wars on video. After a few years of living in the trailer, David and Louise fully abandoned their children for 4 years. They left them there, and the two of them, and two of their youngest children, got an apartment 40 miles south of where that trailer was. The two oldest children were put in charge, and every few days, David would stop by and deliver frozen food. Louise never visited them. For 4 years, these 10 children were left to fend for themselves. And they all had pets, or they had pets as well, and the pets would frequently go to the bathroom in the house, and the children were instructed never to wash above the wrist.
What the fuck? I've been, like, mouth open this entire time.
Yeah.
They've abandoned 10 of their children.
Yes.
They deliver frozen food,
mm-hmm.
and that's it.
Yes. And also, these children were brainwashed because, again, they had no education, and they only listened to mother and father, and even though they were 40 miles away, they still, like, told their children what to do, and Jennifer, and I believe his name was Joshua, the two oldest who were in charge, would still discipline the children by putting them in cages and would only feed them, you know, a little bit because that's what their parents told them to do. And they're living in filth. They're living in filth.
Yeah.
In this tiny trailer. Like
10 children.
Yes.
Where are the neighbors still here? Where are the neighbors?
Yeah, exactly.
They're seeing this shit happen.
Exactly. I mean, they weren't seeing exactly what was happening because, again, they were pretty much nocturnal. So the neighbors would only ever see them or hear them at night. And during the daytime, it was dead. It was quiet. No one would come out. Jennifer and Joshua wanted so badly to escape, but they were also terrified of disobeying their parents. So one day, Jennifer worked up enough courage to leave the house, and she literally ran as far away as she could. Shelley, who was still her neighbor at this point, was driving one of her daughters to school when she saw Jennifer running toward her car. She stopped and picked up Jennifer and said that Jennifer wouldn't tell her her name or her age and didn't even know who was president at the time. She asked Shelley how she could get a car, a job, and an apartment. So Shelley drove her into town to look for work. Jennifer did try to get a job, but since she didn't have any ID, she wouldn't give her name, and literally no social skills, no one would hire her. So since she had no idea what she could even do next, the only thing she had left to do was call her mother, who picked her up.
Oh no.
Authorities said that this attempt at running away should have raised red flags, and someone should have looked into this, but no one ever did.
No shit.
Right. In 2008, when Louise turned 40, she had this kind of midlife crisis. She and David started checking out other religions. Louise started attending a cobra church. Have you ever heard of a cobra church?
Cobra church.
They have a church where there's, like, snakes involved.
She's really losing it.
She got really into snakes. She also got into witchcraft, Satanism, and the occult, and would regularly try to cast spells and use the Ouija board to contact the dead. She and David also decided to open up their marriage and become swingers, and they were going back on gambling trips to Las Vegas, bought new cars, went out drinking all the time, and they also bought expensive gifts for the children, but they were never opened or played with.
What's the fucking point? What are you doing?
Torture.
I know, but
yeah.
Again.
At this point, there was a debt collector showing up at their property with a bounty on them since they basically stole cars and seemed like they were going to plan, they were planning on skipping town. So they were like really, really in debt, and they used like their last little bit of credit to get like cars. And then because they had pretty much no way of paying back these credit companies, they were like, okay, you're stealing these cars and you're going to skip town. So they were like trying to get them. About a month later, though, David and Louise returned to this property for the first time in years and loaded up their 12 children into a van and left in the middle of the night. They took as much as they could, but they left all their pets and they drove away in the middle of the night. Weeks later, when the neighbors finally tried to knock on their doors because now the debt collectors were bothering them, they heard, you know, animals inside, and they opened the doors to let them out. They believed the dog survived after weeks by eating dirty diapers and drinking the water out of the toilets, which were now empty at this point. They said the house smelled like death. And it was the same thing. There was filth and human excrement everywhere, and it didn't seem like any living thing should have been there, ever. And again, Ricky, the neighbor, did go through the house and the trailer and saw the state that they were in and never contacted anyone to look into the family. He and his wife have said that they feel terrible about this now, but nothing was ever done for these children, even when people saw how bad it actually was, and they knew that children were living in this home. So,
unconscionable. You can't, in good conscience, do nothing. That's what I mean.
Oh, yes, yes. Like, yeah. But they were like, oh, everyone minds their business out here.
Shut the fuck up.
You've seen his house. You've seen the inside of his house. Even if before you know, your neighbors were weird and they never came outside and whatever, and you had no idea what was going on. At this point, you have no excuse because you have seen the inside of this house where you know 12 children were living. That is insane. That is absolutely unexcusable. That is evil. That's...
Yeah, but like you see a crime happening.
Yes.
Like... And you are just gonna, quote, mind your own business?
Right.
Like, if somebody got shot in the face in front of your house,
you're like,
would you mind your own business?
Right. Yeah.
No. you would call the cops.
Exactly.
This is what you should do.
Yeah. I don't know how, but they moved to a large house in Southern California after this. They were still very much in debt, but they kept up this image of being the perfect family. And while at the same time, Louise was doing everything she could to distance her children from her family, because she knew that, you know, the more contact she had, the harder it would be to keep up this facade while also literally abusing her children to the highest extent. So these children were being homeschooled, quote unquote, and David got a license or something to classify his homeschooling as a private school, or that's what they called it. That way no one would ever be able to question why his 10 school-aged children never attended school. Later, he even bought a two-story house that he named Sandcastle Day School, and he listed himself as the principal and said that he had 8 students to avoid a visit from social workers. They are going to such, like, great lengths to keep up this image. That way they can continue to abuse their children. Like, I can't even wrap my head around how evil a person has to be to go through that much trouble to not be visited by a social worker so you can keep putting your children in cages, like, and not feeding them. I don't get it.
It seems like Louise had this upbringing, so, like, she seems to, like, have been normalized to this type of shit.
That's no excuse. That is no excuse.
It's not an excuse. But what the fuck is the husband? David. What is David?
They're evil people.
Did that come from? Like, he was just, he must have been just, like, fucking born with it. Like, I just don't understand how you seemingly had such this, like, you got everything.
Right.
And then you take this,
like. It just doesn't make sense. Well, the thing is like, and I'm sure I've said this before, but people can go through trauma and still be good people in the future. You know, trauma doesn't make you an evil person.
Yes, but David has gone through no trauma.
No, but apparently. David aside, I'm talking about Louise. Like, just because, that's not an excuse. And I know you're not saying it's an excuse, but I'm just saying, like, even though Louise went through some terrible trauma in her childhood, which is terrible, and no child should ever, ever have to go through that. But that is not an excuse for the way she is treating her children in the future. She is an evil, evil person who should rot in hell forever or wherever. I don't know. She should die. Anyway, Jennifer had the highest level of education, and she was at a third grade level. All of the other children had the education of about a kindergartner, and it remained that way throughout their entire time under the care of their parents.
Could they read?
No.
Wow.
Yep. Over time, the punishment they used only got worse. The children would be locked up in their rooms, and on many occasions would be tied or chained to the furniture. After Louise's midlife crisis, she began to get more involved in the children's lives, which is not a good thing, and which would mean that she'd be around more often and would physically abuse the children and was angry all the time. The children were terrified of her. They would spend 20 hours a day locked in their rooms. They were fed the absolute bare minimum to keep them alive, and they had no access to TV, radio, or newspapers, so they were completely cut off from the outside world. They had no idea what anything was. Like, they didn't know what a normal family even looked like. They had no concept of what normal could have been. Something really odd was David and Louise encouraged the kids to keep journals about their daily lives, which I guess was literally their only form of entertainment.
So
I guess
they could read.
Oh yes, I guess they could write and read, I guess, but I don't really know how, because they only had the education of a kindergartner, so I don't know. But on one occasion, some of the teen girls went into their parents' room and used some of Louise's makeup and put on her clothes. But when they were caught, David's idea of punishment was chaining up all 12 children. Jonathan would steal food when he was hungry, and he was punished by hog-tying him, but he bit through the ropes and escaped. So he gnawed through ropes. After that, because the ropes didn't work, they chained him to the bed rail, but he managed to slip out of that, so Louise and David got bigger and thicker chains. And throughout the next 6 years, they would leave him chained up for weeks or even months at a time.
Months.
That left permanent damage to his spine. Louise's temper was very short, and sometimes there would be no reason at all for her to go into a blind rage. And one of her forms of punishment was called pitching. This is, the children called it pitching. This was when she would throw her children around by their hair, and she would also choke them, punch them in the head, and slap them in the face. She once caught her 7-year-old daughter doing something she wasn't supposed to do and threw her around the room and down the stairs. She could barely move for days, but was never treated for her injuries and was never brought to a hospital. Despite all of this, around this time was when Louise and David started a joint Facebook account where they would post pictures of themselves and their children all dressed up in identical clothing, looking like the perfect family. They had an annual pass to Disney World for the whole family, and Louise would dress up the children in identical clothing to take a picture and post it on Facebook for everyone to see. There was also photos of just David and Louise at Disney World without their children, and their profile was David and Louise looking lovingly into each other's eyes.
What the fuck can you say about that?
That's what I mean. Like, they are pure evil. They know what they were doing. They knew everything. Obviously, I mean, they're full grown adults. They knew what they were doing, but like, you can now see just how sinister it is. Like, they would post pictures. These children they were only allowed to shower once a year. I was going to talk about that later. I mean, it comes up later, but they showered once a year. And, you know, they were barely fed, but at the same time, they were dressed up in identical clothing and taken a picture and posted it online. And people would be like, beautiful family, so perfect, blah, blah, blah. How do you do?
Yeah.
You know? Okay. This is going to be kind of a long story, but let's just keep going. Whew. Louise was also obsessed with the reality TV show Kate Plus 8. And said that one of the main reasons she moved her family to California was so that they could get their own reality TV show because she said they'd be perfect for reality TV and would be much better than Kate Plus 8.
She's delusional. Jesus Christ.
They would use their children as props for these photos and post them on Facebook. I mean, obviously. So now we're in 2011. And David's brother Randy and his family came to visit David and Louise. David's niece Miranda was especially excited because she had never met her cousins before, and she bonded the most with David's daughter Jordan. Jordan confided in her and told her that she dreamed of singing professionally. She told Miranda that she had written 141 songs, and her most recent one was for Miranda. Miranda loved this and asked Jordan if she could post videos of her singing, and Jordan was so excited. This is, you know, not really that important to the story, but I just wanted to take a moment. We're going to take a moment to breathe. And also, Jordan is the reason that the children are okay today. And she would like post videos of her singing on YouTube, like secretly. So it's just, wow. Yeah.
She wrote 141 songs.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's wild.
I know. But after that, things went back to their normal. There were a few instances where kids got sick enough or hurt enough that they needed to go to the hospital. And every time, Louise would coach them on what to say in order not to raise any red flags. The children's 2 small meals a day turned into 1, and they were forbidden from exercising. Jennifer would cook the children's meals and would call the children down one by one in an order that Louise specified, and the children would eat standing up at the kitchen counter one by one and have a little bit of tap water. They would either eat a peanut butter sandwich, a jalapeno bologna sandwich, or a burrito and chips. That was it. And once they were finished eating, they returned to their bedrooms. Meanwhile, Louise and David ate great. They would order pizza or get subs or Mexican food, and they would get various pies and they would put them on the counter for the children to look at, but never touched. The children would literally have to watch these pies mold over time and then get thrown out. So they would never touch them. They would just leave them there for the children to look at. And then they would mold, and then they would throw out. And they never were allowed to have any of their parents' food, and the parents would order this food and then eat it in front of them. These children were only allowed, like I said earlier, 1 bath a year. They never changed their clothes and would often soil themselves when they were chained up for hours on end. So they were literally sitting in their feces and, you know, pee. In 2013, Louise gave birth to her 13th and final child. At this point, Louise would only post photos of Jana, who was the final child, on social media. When her friends and family started to ask why, she would make up, you know, whatever excuse. By this time, Jordan, who was 15 years old, decided that she was going to escape from her parents' house. It would take her 2 more years to be able to break free from her parents, but at this point, the seed has been planted. She is planning on escaping. During the Christmas season of 2015, Louise and David gave their children, quote, good treatment. That was their Christmas gift. This would last anywhere from 2 days to 2 weeks, and the children were allowed out of their rooms, they could eat a little bit more, they played games, and they spent some quality time together. However, this didn't really last long, and they soon returned to their normal. Shockingly, Louise enrolled Joshua in a few classes at Mount St. Jacinto College. He took about 15 credits a semester and did really well. He was even on the honor roll.
What?
I don't know. I don't know how that
is.
This
is a college?
Yeah. I don't know.
Wow.
Louise would drop him off and pick him up, and sometimes she'd walk him from class to class and wait in the hallway. His classmates said the same thing you'd expect. Joshua was very introverted, very skinny. Many of his classmates thought that he was just very poor and starving. He smelled bad. He had perpetual bedhead, and there was obviously something off about him. One day, one of his classmates talked to him, and she walked Joshua out to the parking lot where Louise was waiting for him by her big van. He told his mother that this classmate didn't have any friends either, and he asked if they could be friends. He was like, she doesn't have friends either. Can we be friends, please? And Louise just kind of sized her up and said, yeah, sure, whatever. Then Joshua got in the car, they drove off, and he never returned to classes after this. Now we're going to skip forward to 2017. Both of Louise's parents have passed away at this point, and she had no real relationship with her sisters. She would take out her anger on her youngest children, and there was really no way of predicting what would set her off, and they were all terrified of her. That Christmas season, Joshua had gotten a new cell phone, so he had given his old one to Jordan. So what was happening was Jennifer and Joshua and, like, the oldest of the children were rewarded if they told on their younger siblings. So if someone did something and they reported it to their parents, they were given a reward. So because of that, Jennifer and Joshua kind of got a little bit of better treatment sometimes. And Joshua had a cell phone, and now he had a new cell phone, so he gave his old one to Jordan. It was deactivated, but she could still access the internet with her Wi-Fi in her home, and she had heard about social media from Jennifer and was able to set up fake accounts under the name Lacey Swan. She connected with Justin Bieber fans and animal rights activists. She created an Instagram account, and most daring of all, she created a YouTube channel where she posted videos of herself singing the songs that she had written. She also had met a boy from India online who she confided in, and he encouraged her to escape and notify authorities. At this time, David had gotten the news that he would be transferred again to Oklahoma, but Jordan knew that if they moved to Oklahoma, nothing would change. And David and Louise agreed that they were just going to chain all of the children up once they got into the new house in Oklahoma, and they were about to move in the next few days. So Jordan knows that if she doesn't do something right now, she's going to move to Oklahoma, and it's just going to be worse. Like, it's just going to keep going. At least 5 of the kids knew about this early morning escape plan, and they knew that there was this place called Vegas, and it was one of the happiest times they had had in their life. So they were like, we need to get to Vegas, because the parents renewed their vows, like, a couple of times, and they took the children to Vegas and, like, took pictures of them in Vegas. They're all in matching dresses, matching whatever, and they were like, we need to get to Vegas because that's where the happiness is. And this was just ingrained in their heads. And on the morning of January 14th, 2017, Jordan escaped the family home through the first story bedroom window. Before she left, she faked a lump in her bed to make it look like she was still sleeping there. And she ran down the road and called 911 with Joshua's old cell phone. Even though it was deactivated, she was still able to call emergency services, because that's still a thing you can do. And she told the dispatcher her name and that her parents are abusive. She said 2 of her siblings were tied up right now at home, and the dispatcher asked a few questions, one of them being, is anyone on any medication? And Jordan told her she didn't even know what medication was.
Wow, that's gotta be chilling.
Yeah, and actually, you can hear this 911 call if you, like, look it up. She sounds like a 7-year-old. Like, she's 17 years old, and she sounds like an absolute child. It's very chilling to hear.
Yeah, but I mean, not surprising.
No,
right?
It's not. But I'm just saying, like, it's insane. So Jordan also told her that they live in filth, and sometimes it's so dirty that when she wakes up, she can't breathe.
Ugh.
So after this call, the police are sent to the home, and David and Louise were arrested on site.
Finally.
Police were horrified by what they found inside the home. First of all, it was filthy. Like, feces and urine everywhere, kind of filthy. It looked like a hoarder house. There was just stuff everywhere. The children were scattered in different rooms, and multiple of them were chained up. The 3 of them who were chained to their beds had been there since October, and it was January. So that's They were only like let go from these chains to brush their teeth, and that's pretty much it. They were allowed to like get up and use the bathroom a couple times, but really not that much. Agents from CPS and APS, which is Child Protective Services and Adult Protective Services, showed up to take the children into care immediately. Because again, not all of these children are child age. There's a good amount of them that are over 18 at this point. And the children were malnourished and taken out of the house in their PJs. The officers watched after them and ordered them all food, and they were hooked up to IVs and started antibiotics immediately. Over the next few hours, CPS and APS spoke with the children, and all of the children looked like they had the mental capacity of someone a lot younger than they actually were. Police were shocked to find out that 7 of the children that they found were actually adults ranging in age from 18 to 29 years old.
29.
Jennifer was 29 years old at that time. She was 29 and 5'3 and weighed 80 pounds. All of the children were anywhere from 20 to 50 pounds underweight. Jordan, who made the 911 call, was 17 at the time, but from hearing the call, she sounded like a 9-year-old, or, you know, like I said earlier. That when they were asked who was the head boss in charge, they all agreed that it was their mother. The children were showered and their clothes were taken as evidence. David and Louise Turpin were transferred to the Robert Presley Detention Center in Riverside, California, and they were charged with 9 counts of torture and 10 counts of child endangerment, and their bail was set at $9 million each. So they were not going to get out of this one with freaking credit, you know? Like,
yeah.
When they were taken away in handcuffs by the police, David cried uncontrollably, but Louise smirked at the cops and spat at the ground twice. At them.
Dude, if I was the arresting officer, I don't know how you could hold back the like urge to just bash her head.
Yeah, I don't know. Oof. Hospital staff actually paid out of their own pockets to buy clothing for these children, and they had their own wing of the hospital with a 24-hour guard stationed at the entrance. The hospital also approached the Corona Chamber of Commerce for assistance and were able to raise thousands of dollars and get the children new clothes, shoes, games, and toiletries. From that point on, more and more care packages arrived at the hospital for them. Hospital staff taught the children basic skills like washing their faces and brushing their teeth and, you know, brushing their hair. And they also experienced fresh produce for the first time in their life in the hospital. The children were hesitant at first, but they tried blueberries, strawberries, and raspberries, and the first time they saw a tomato, they were scared of it, but a nurse ate one to show the kids that it was fine to eat, and after, they tried it, and they loved it. I'm starting to tear up. This has me fucked up. I'm about to cry. Okay, the Chamber of Commerce gave each child a bag of new clothing and raised $200,000 for them. One of Jennifer's former classmates wrote to her on a Facebook page and apologized for joining in with the students who would bully her. It said, quote, "It is nothing but sobering to know that the person that sat across from you at the lunch table went home to squalor and filth when you went home to a warm meal and a bedtime story. A simple act of kindness and acceptance may be the ray of hope that person needs. Befriend the Jennifer Turpins of the world." Which I just wanted to put in there because that is so true. Like, you know, you don't kick someone when they're down, especially a kid. I know kids are so mean and whatever, but like, God, you know, you gotta befriend people like that. You gotta be that light for them. Donations continued to pour in, and members of the Rotary Club donated iPads for the children to start using as learning tools. And even a homeless man donated to these children. He gave $2.38 and said to tell the children that the world is watching and they love them. At their parents' sentencing, the public heard from the Turpin children for the first time. Jennifer started by saying, "My parents took my whole life from me, but now I'm taking my life back." But most of the children's statements spoke positively about their parents, including one saying that sentencing of 25 years to life was too long. These children even forgave their parents. Joshua Turpin, who was 27 at the time, read one of his younger sister's statements that said, "I love both of my parents so much. Although it may not have been the best way of raising us, I'm glad that they did because it made me the person I am today." Jessica also said, "I want to thank them for teaching me about God and faith. I hope that they never lose faith. God looks at the heart. I know he sees theirs." So these children are brainwashed to the highest degree. They have no concept of what a normal life or positive treatment should look like. So they're sad. They don't want their parents to go to jail. They don't know what is the reality of the situation. You know, it's chilling. It's I don't even know what else to say about it. It's just chilling. In her statement, Joy Turpin, who is one of the daughters, said, "Every year from as far back as I can remember, our parents tried to give us the nicest Christmas they could." And she said that their mother didn't want to tie them up with ropes and chains, but it was necessary because they consumed too much sugar and caffeine. And, you know, they had this sugar and caffeine because their father once fell asleep and crashed while he was driving. So they think it's their fault. They think that them being tied up and chained up for months at a time is their fault. That's where their heads are at. While the Turpin children's statements provided a nuanced and forgiving portrait of the family, Riverside Judge Bernard J. Schwartz, in his final statements before sentencing, was more absolute in condemning the abusive parents. He said, "If they do thrive, it will not be because of you both, but in spite of you both. The only reason your punishment is less than the maximum is because you spared your children the humiliation of testifying." In February of 2019, both parents pled guilty on 14 felony counts, including cruelty to a dependent adult, child cruelty, torture, and false imprisonment. And in April of the same year, they were sentenced to life imprisonment with the possibility of parole in 25 years. Although experts believe that they will never receive parole due to the severity of the crime, making it effectively a life sentence.
So do you mean the ultimate punishment meaning the death penalty? Like, they were spared of the death penalty because their children didn't have to testify?
Yeah, I guess they took a deal. Basically being like, okay, we'll plead guilty. That way we can end the trial sooner.
How is it not life?
I mean, period. It is. It pretty much is. But it's not exactly life, but it is life, you know?
Yeah, I just don't like that it's pretty much life.
Yeah.
Because, if you are up for parole, you still have to have, like, a hearing, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't even think they deserve that.
No, they don't. They definitely don't. And during the trial, like, David was crying and Louise was crying and they, like, mouthed, "I'm sorry" to the children. And the children, like, accepted their apology. And, you know, like, they're putting on a show even in the courtroom. Louise is an evil person. David is they're evil on earth. Like, they're evil, evil people.
Yeah. I mean, of course they are doing that. I mean,
yeah, of course. But I mean, seeing them cry in the videos of that, you know, courtroom, it just made my blood boil. Like, I wanted to punch them through the screen.
Yeah, and, like, these children are gonna take so long to recover and come around and, like, realize what monsters their parents are.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be easier for the younger children because they didn't have as many years.
Yeah, but Jennifer had 29. Almost 30 years.
She had 29 years. Joshua had 27 years.
Yeah, and I don't know. I still am so shocked that he was able to take 15 college credits and do well.
I know.
That shows extreme intelligence despite his circumstances and education. Like, absolutely. That's just mind-bending.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, probably is one of the only good, like, I don't even want to say good, but, like, just, like, a bright thing.
Yeah.
That happened.
Yeah, that's kind of why I, like, wanted to include the little things about, like, Jordan having that good experience with her cousin and, you know, the YouTube channel and Joshua going to college because, like, it's just, you gotta grasp onto something, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have any more words about that. But Jessica enrolled in college and lives in an apartment, and she's getting around by bike and public transportation. Joshua said that he's working toward a bachelor's degree in software engineering and plans to continue on to graduate school. He said that he still has nightmares about being chained up in his home, but he said that this is the past and this is now, or that was the past and this is now. And in the past year of freedom, he said that he's learned to bike, swim, and cook healthy meals. He said, "I love my parents and have forgiven them for a lot of the things that they did to us. Since January, I've learned so much and have become very independent." And, you know, the younger children were taken into foster homes and are, you know, getting help as well. Riverside County Deputy District Attorney Kevin Beecham, who was part of the prosecution in the case against the parents, David and Louise Turpin, told People that the children have made positive progress. He said they're all happy. They are moving on with their lives. And several of the adult children have been living on their own, while others in the group are in group homes, and the 6 youngest ones have been adopted. The younger ones didn't have as many years of abuse or neglect, so they are able to rebound a little bit better. The siblings have also been taking care of their mental health, and all 13 of them are still meeting together, and some of them have changed their names to be, you know, a little bit more private. They are receiving really good help with therapy, counseling, and a lot of psychological assistance. They are exponentially in a better place than they were before. And he said, they want people to know that they are survivors. They want to be independent now. Whew. And that is the story of the Turpin family.
Yeah. This is just another story that, like, I don't know, I feel like proves that there's, like, no bottom to how evil a person can be. It's just, like, as soon as you think that there's some, like, this is the worst, there's, like, another situation that proves that wrong.
Yeah. And I just realized I forgot to give my sources at the beginning. I got a lot of my information from the Human Monsters podcast. There's an episode on YouTube. And it is like 3 hours long. I did not include all the information from that episode. So if you want to hear more about it, you can go listen to that. I got some information from Wikipedia and a People article by Christine Pelisek. But yeah, I mean, there is far more to this story. I mean, there's like little things here and there, and you know, it's just the same thing over and over. And I just felt like we had like, you know, the most important stuff outlined, and you know, if you want to hear the rest, you can go listen to that episode. But I don't know, I felt like it was important to talk about. It's obviously still a fresh story, it's obviously horrifying, but there were so many people in those children's lives that could have done something, and I just think that it's really important to be aware, you know, to look out for things like that, and if you see any sign of it, to report something like that. Because if you're wrong, the worst case scenario is, you know, CPS shows up and they don't find anything and they just have a headache for a day.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, if they have nothing to hide, if there's nothing going on, then they shouldn't be worried if CPS shows up, you know? Like, you know, it's a headache, but it's much better to deal with a day of headache than it is to potentially leave a child in a home that is abusive.
For 30 years. Almost 30 years.
Yes, obviously. But I'm just trying to really drive home that if you see something, say something.
Yeah, the bystander effect was pretty, I don't know, I can't even wrap my head around it.
No.
Just, like, the teachers in the beginning, then, like, the police report that was never followed up on, the neighbors.
Yeah, there was, like, the one or two times that they did end up getting medical care. They should have had follow-up appointments that were never made and never, you know, brought to them. So that should have been checked up on. Yeah, I can't get over the fact that the teachers never did anything. I mean, obviously they only had Jennifer for 2 years, but at the same time, it's their responsibility to say something. And obviously she was showing multiple signs of abuse, and it could have stopped at Jennifer, who was the oldest, when she was, you know, 7 years old. It could have been over. So I'm just disappointed. I'm disgusted. And also those neighbors, you know, the neighbors that lived across the street from them for 10 years, they saw the house, they saw what the children were living in, and they didn't do anything. What's that about? Like, what's that about?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's it. We're going to have a much lighter story next week, and we hope you come back to listen to it. What is your good thing? Do you want me to start?
Yeah, you can start this week. Go for it.
My good thing is I am a week away from when we're recording this episode. I'm a week away from going home to seeing my family for the first time since Christmas of 2019. So I'm very excited to see my sisters and my parents and my grandparents and my friends and everyone. So that is something that I'm very much looking forward to.
Amen.
Yep.
My good thing is I keep bringing up the vaccine, but... I don't care.
Yeah, that's
and
fine.
I will be like the two weeks after you get your second shot. So like I'm fully protected. Like I think I have 4 more days left.
That's great.
At the time of recording.
Yes.
But like when the episode comes out, I think I'll only have like 1 or 2. But like I'm like really close to being like as good as it's ever going to be, really.
Yeah.
As far as like being immune. So.
Yep. That's a good thing. Yeah.
No masks. Now like the CDC was just like pretty much like, well,
yeah, I mean, that requires a lot of trust in other people that I don't know that I have yet.
Yeah, so, it's gonna take a long time to come around.
Yeah,
but I think that is pretty insanely amazing.
Yeah, we're definitely moving in the right direction. I mean, especially in Los Angeles, which is kind of shocking to me. Like, we're in a really good spot as far as the whole country goes, which is, again, really crazy. But
wild. But, love it.
Yeah.
Keep going.
We hope that you guys are having a good week. We send lots of love. Take care of yourself a little bit extra today. And thank you so much for listening. If you would like to follow up with, you know, the pictures that we post of each of the cases we talk about, follow us on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or really anything in general, send us an email. We're going to do a listener's episode really soon. I know I keep saying that, but for real this time. we have a Twitter. You can follow us at nottoday_podcast, but the T on the end of podcast is a 3. You can follow us on TikTok at nottodaypodcast, and just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect to your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.